Hello, everyone. Today I have a special guest. It is Rebecca, aka Blonde. Welcome back.
Hello. I will try to prevent you from having to bleep this whole conversation, but this is pre-recorded. I know why you did that, because you think I'm going to say some no-no words, and then the Bobbies are going to come knocking on your door. He tried to make an excuse, but I know what's going on.
Well, we have to, yeah, I have to, the Storm Troopers will come in, what we call them, Keir Starmer. I kind of have a soft, I've kind of developed a soft spot for Keir Starmer, despite the fact that everybody hates him, which is that, I don't know, like everybody hate, like imagine you had a president that everybody hated.
I know I that do.
Must be difficult, right? And he just doesn't care. Oh yeah, you have the same thing. I don't know. There's an autism about Keir Starmer where he just doesn't process stuff like a normal person.
He is kind of retarded.
Yeah, and because of that, I don't know. There's something about that. Maybe I relate to it in some way. how have you been anyway? How have you been?
I'm doing well. We've been planning this event in New York City, and it's just, I've never done an event before. So it's just so much more work than I anticipated. And, you know, we're trying to get butts in seats there. So if you're in New York City or thereabouts on July 18th, go to my pinned tweet. I'm blondes_tweets, and you can buy a ticket, and it's going to be some excellent conversation. We're going to have a panel discussion, some speakers, Zach Logos just signed on. So it's going to be a good time. There will be mandatory merriment because I have never been away from my children before. So everyone's going to have a good time. We're going to have fun. It's going to be a good time. There's going to be no Antifa. Nothing like that is going to happen. I don't know. I'm really looking forward to it. Not just because I'm going to be away from my children, which I'm sure will be fun for about 2 hours, and then I will regret it and feel very guilty and sad. So
that's July the 18th. Indeed. in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
what made you go, isn't that like shit lib central?
It is indeed. We've been trying to plan something like this for about a year, and we were just getting rejected from venues left, right, and sideways, but miraculously the place that pulled through happens to be in the devil's lair. So that's where we're doing it. We're doing it anyway.
Great. Wow. I used to be in and out in New York a lot. I used to work in events years ago, and these were all like banking guys, right? Banking guys, market data, reference data, and all this sort of stuff. And I had to I had to meet and greet all the people, and they were all there, and some of them were pretty senior, like C-level guys and so on. And we used to hold these like literally in Times Square. So the venue was like on Times Square itself. And there was this kind of, the venue had this like rooftop bar. It was kind of quite trendy. It was quite trendy, right? And I remember on my first event in New York, one of the speakers I had this giant like handlebar mustache, right? Right. And he was an older guy. And we were doing drinks up at this top bar just to try to get everybody eased before the event, which was the following day. You know, people were like doing balloons and stuff, and I didn't get involved in that sort of stuff. It was like, all right, I'll come and have a drink with the speakers. So anyway, he was like, oh, I'm gonna have cocktails, what do you want, right? So I don't know, I ordered some cocktail. He came back, the waiter brought the cocktail over, we sat down, and this guy with the giant handlebar mustache said, listen, I want to suck your dick. I was like, "Whoo, right, what do I do here?" Because this guy is from a very senior investment bank. He is one of my top speakers on this event. How do I deal right now? So you being
so
a hot
you,
woman,
you let him suck your dick, right?
No. So you being a hot woman, you're probably used to this sort of thing.
Nope.
Me, being a bloke, I had no idea what to do at all. So like, what do I was like, right, I'm trying to be professional. Like, how do I deal with this situation right here? And I just said, listen, you've got the wrong end of the set. I am kind of as straight as they come. And he said, you're making me so hot right now. And I was like, what do I do here? So I don't know, like, I don't know how I kind of managed to, I just was like, I was nervous. So I just started talking. And like, he started like telling me about, you know, how hard it was growing up a gay kid in New York in the 60s. I was like, now what do I do here? Anyway, that was something.
He made the famous mistake of thinking that all Brits, all Brit males sexually experiment with other men. The old Bride's Head Revisited mistake.
Yeah, that was.
I'm sorry that happened to you.
So, you're going to have to send me that Twitter link, by the way, because I deleted my Twitter.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I can't be dealing with it anymore.
We miss you, but I found your reasoning sound and convincing. It made me want to delete my own Twitter, which I am not.
You should, to be more present in the world and with your kids and so on and so forth.
I do find that I don't doom scroll and I don't spend very much time on it. Like I have it capped on my phone to a half hour a day, and I rarely.
So your phone locks you out, basically.
It's like, yep, you're done. I mean, you can just delay the timer. It's very easy. But I don't know. I don't. I'm at mental capacity with world events and reading Substacks and things like that. And so I just don't do the doom scrolling. Also, there's so much false information. I find it very useful for getting the news quickly, but you really do have to wait a whole news cycle before the real information comes out about any given event. So I don't know. I understand your reasoning, but I'm pretty good at not getting too involved. And I only tweet maybe once a day. So
yeah, very good self-control from you.
With that.
Yeah, I don't know though. I kind of feel like, even beyond all my personal reasons and so on, don't you think that since it's become like the Elon Musk thing, that it's kind of like, you know, the old Twitter was trying to push you towards the liberal worldview, let's just say. This Twitter is trying to push you towards a particular type of right view.
Wow, you really can't say anything in that country, can you?
Well, you know what? You're right. Okay, let's put it this way. You know, it's another day, and Elon Musk is trying to get you to read Gad Saad's book on suicidal empathy.
I know.
And now we have to talk about, you know, this. There's a type of discourse that is dominated on there. And, you know, back in the day, like 4 or 5 years ago, it used to be a good place to meet other interesting people. When was the last time you met anyone saw anybody interesting on there that's not just repeating all the same crap that you get from all the other people?
It's just, I don't know, if that's much of a reflection of Twitter, though. I mean, the space has become relatively incestuous just on its own. I mean, I do interviews with the same people and everything like that. Not that I'm complaining. They always have new and interesting things to say, but you're right. I'm not seeing a lot of new ideas and new voices. I'll stay on it, though. I'm salty because I was banned on Twitter for 7 years. And so just having an account is something of a novelty still.
Right. But you see, during that 7-year process, you learned how to not be, you learned to live without it.
Yeah.
So now it's just an accessory to you.
Totally.
Not a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, I think that's the problem that happens, is that if you let it, it can kind of take over, or kind of like it can kind of be there even when you're doing something else.
Mm,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, you do get inundated with these substandard opinions. That's why I like Substack so much, because I can cultivate my own news feed from people that I want to read long form content from. And then I watch your videos and a handful of other videos, and that's pretty much it. That's all I really want to watch. I dip into the Nap sphere periodically. I get a lot of information from them. But
what's the Nap sphere? What's that?
Judge Napolitano.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, but
who do you? I basically don't watch anyone anymore. Who do you watch?
I listen to Devin Stack's streams. I watch all of Cameron McGregor's videos. I watch your videos. Jolly Heretic is a good one. Zoomer Historian has some good content. Let's see. And then I read Multipolarity Press, Millennial Woe Substack, Cameron Substack, and then a lot of financial news.
Right. Mm. Okay.
What about you? Who are you watching still? Listening to?
I watch like a cooking videos.
Mm. Nah, yeah. Well, who's your favorite? I watch a lot of... That is how I learned how to be such an excellent chef.
Well, Marco Pierre White is my favorite because he's like...
Oh, okay.
Because he's like a psycho. my least favorite, and I'm not trying to diss America here, but I've come to really detest... There's a style of American cook video that drives me crazy.
Are you going to talk about Josh Wiseman? I don't know if I can tolerate.
I don't know any names, right?
Okay. But
they're always like slightly New York and gay. Funny enough, they're always like
Babish. You're talking about Babish.
Slightly camp kind of, but it's always like, right, today we're going to teach you how to cook a traditional shepherd's pie. In England, they call it a shepherd's pie. I'm gonna do it with my personal little twist, and it's like, and then it's, do you remember that meme of the like the autistic girl putting the do you remember that they were putting like the different shapes?
She's, yeah, like
the circle, and it's like watching American, it's like, what are you doing? You're putting cumin. Don't put fucking cumin in a shepherd's pie.
No, I understand. Like, I'll watch Italian cooking channels and they'll put cream in the carbonara. I'm like yelling. I'm like, what are you doing? You're ruining the whole thing. No, I like Chef John. He's American. He's been great. He's been phoning it in for a few years though, but he really taught me all the basics.
So, yeah. Apart from that, what else? You know, stuff my daughter watches.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, she's into like watching. She got into this whole thing of watching people watching like you, like there's this whole genre of like slop gamers YouTube, like, yes, somebody playing Mario, right? But it's geared for kids.
Yeah,
you've seen this stuff. There's like, there's one called Manx Ninja Pig. There's one called Beck Bro or whatever. And last week I was like, that's it, these
no
guys
more.
They are banned. I did it because it is such brain rot.
Oh, and
it's,
yeah,
like you should be watching, like, in my mind I'm thinking, like, you should be learning how I don't know, how is bread made? Mm-hmm. Like, what's the whole process of cutting the wheat and processing it? And I don't know what I imagine the 6-year-old should be watching, but
no, that's what I make my daughter watch. And then if she wants to watch cartoons, like, I'll put on old timey cartoons, like the really old ones, the racist ones. I'll put those on. And then, but she's really into cooking videos, and we've been watching Wallace and Gromit lately.
Well, that's a British show. That's a British show. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know. Recently I've been, my main thing is now, I want to, after having ditched my Twitter, I now want to get her, my daughter, screen free. How do you deal with it? I mean, as a fellow parent, how do you deal with screens? Because I feel like it's so easy just to, you know, then stick the TV on, they're watching something, and then before you know it, it's an hour.
Right.
You know, and it's like, I'm like, I can always tell when my daughter's watching, you know, she's either been playing on a computer or watching something for too long, she gets kind of, she starts getting agitated. I can see.
Yeah, a little spurty.
Yeah, she should be doing something else, and she's starting to kind of flip out a little bit. I would rather it not happen. So I, like, how do you deal with this yourself?
Well, my kids don't have any independent viewing time. They don't have iPads. I don't give them my phone. I don't do any of that. And so everything's co-viewing. And so I do work. And when my husband's gone, like, sometimes I need like an hour to do some work. So I typically try to limit screen time, and then we do an hour of Star Trek The Next Generation before bed. So like one episode before bed. And so that's all I'm doing right now. But you know, they like Bluey. Love Bluey. Which is, in terms of kids' screen time, it's not that bad.
How do you deal with Picard? Because he's such a boomer liberal. You said Star Trek The Next Generation, did you?
I know. See, I grew up on it. And so the nostalgia factor overrides the propaganda. But I can talk through the propaganda with Emmeline. And that's very helpful. I'll be like, listen, this is a future multiracial world without money. This is never going to exist. We're always going to have races. There's always going to be social status and financial hierarchy. So this is a totally fictional world. And then there's an episode where Riker, who's, you know, this just would never happen in Riker's world, where he bangs this gender neutral woman. Right. I don't know if you remember this episode, but like everybody on our planet doesn't have a gender, and she's one of the ones that leans towards female. She's totally androgynous and disgusting. And he's like, I love this woman and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, listen, Emmeline, Riker would never do this, because Riker would abandon you after he loves you. And he's that type of man, and genderless worlds don't exist. And so it was a good opportunity to teach her about transgender propaganda. So I just, co-viewing is important, because you can point these things out in real time. And now she's recognizing propaganda on her own. And I'm very proud of her for that. She'll see like a commercial or something like that and be like, why is this white man married to this black woman? And I'm like, yes, that's my girl. Recognize these things early on in life. And I think that that's important, giving your kids tools to recognize propaganda, because they're inundated with it from the second that they are born. And if you can give them those tools, I think that co-viewing, you can teach your children a lot about things that they're going to encounter in the real world on their own soon.
Can I just get back to Picard a second, though? Because
I will talk about Star Trek The Next Generation all day. Well, I have been to two conventions, one of them as an adult.
Every situation with Picard, I mean, maybe I'm just remembering this wrong. You know, I haven't watched Star Trek for about 20 years, but it was here, it was always on. There was this weird little block where it's like 6 p.m. and it'd be like Simpsons, Star Trek. It'd be like a little weird block at 6 p.m. And, you know, so, yeah, you kind of watch it after the kid show, like after the children's programs had finished, there'd be like a bit where Star Trek was on. And all I can remember is like every episode, Mr. Worf, what should we do? Let's blow the fucking thing up! No, it's not, you know, it's not, that's not the Starfleet way. We must negotiate. We will, through the power of diplomacy, we're going to come to an agreement with the aliens. We're going to show them a better way.
Right.
But Captain Picard, the Borg are destroying the entire universe.
Yes.
No, we must stick to our morals. Yes. He was so irritating. I hated him.
Yeah. That I hated that plot line with I-Borg. Like, oh, this individual Borg is going to reverse assimilate the entire Borg, and they're going to stop. You know, they blew up Guinan's entire society. It was like 7 billion people. It's like, if you have an opportunity to destroy the Borg, you do it. See, Worf is usually right about these things. And sometimes Captain Picard listens to him. I don't know. I'm able to overcome it because he's so hot. He's just the hottest man that's ever lived. I just, oh my gosh. Like, even as a child, I was like, I love his bald head and his commanding attitude. And I've always just had a thing. I've always had a thing for it. But yes, it is really annoying. It's not really his fault, though, because the Prime Directive itself is stupid.
So if you had a choice between Riker and Picard, you go for Picard?
Of course. It's like you don't even know me. Of course. Picard, wow. Every time. Riker is a disaster of a man. Won't settle down. He's got a good beard, though.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there was a period where he didn't have a beard. Is that right?
Season one and part of season two. It was unfortunate.
Right. The person, I mean, I'm going to get off Star Trek in a second, but the person I always felt sorry for in Star Trek, was it Wesley Crusher, the little?
Yeah.
Now, he was surrounded by a lot of domineering women, wasn't he?
He was. Beverly Crusher's mom, domineering.
And he'd be like, oh, all right, get down to count, go and speak to that Eastern European trick for a while. You know, you need counseling. You couldn't move without counseling.
Yeah, yeah. She really, her partial empathic powers really dominated the Enterprise. They never should have accepted her into Starfleet Academy.
And then
I met her twice.
You met Deanna Troi twice. But then the other thing I remember, and again, I'm going on 20-year-old memories, but I could be misremembering this, is that after a while, Picard was like, you know, in that bit where he was in the bridge, oh, I can't decide what to do. I know. I'm going to go and talk to Whoopi Goldberg. I'm going to have a chat with Whoopi Goldberg, and she, through her magic wisdom, is going to give me the insight, and then I got it.
Yes, magical Negro stuff in that, for sure, yeah. I can't argue with any of this, but childhood nostalgia, I can't overcome it. I can't do it. I still love Star Trek The Next Generation. I know it's a libertarian fantasy. I know there's racial propaganda and gender propaganda, but I still love it.
So how often do you go to these conventions then? Is that your...
It's been 10 years.
Okay. All right. that's kind of acceptable. I used to go to these, I used to be into board gaming, right? Mm-hmm. But not like Monopoly. Like
Dungeons and Dragons?
No. Like hardcore German economic games. They were really, really hardcore. So there was this games expo that we used to go to, and attached to the game, because as you can imagine, people who play board games are nerdy, right?
No.
So it would always be attached to this other kind of like Comic-Con thing that was going on next door. And I always remember I saw at one of those conventions, there was like, they had all the tables. And you know, when I was a kid, I was into pro wrestling, as you know. And there was a pro wrestler called the Honky Tonk Man. You may remember him. He was like a kind of Elvis impersonator. But obviously now Honky Tonk Man is like in his 60s or something. and I'll never forget it. There was Dave Prowse, Darth Vader, right, sitting there on his little table. Nobody there to see Vader. There was Honky Tonk Man, nobody there. And then for some reason, Winston Zeddemore from Ghostbusters, you know, the black ghost, but the black ghost, he was there, and his cue was like right up the thing, right up the back of the side, you know. And there was that, what was his name, Hodor from Game of Thrones, you know, Hodor, he was there, nobody cared about him. Zeddemore ran the block, and everybody else was just like, and all I could think of is like, if you're the Honky Tonk Man or Dave Prowse or Hodor, that is so destroying. And
what a bummer of a day.
Yeah, so that was. But then another part of me was thinking, Winston Zeddemore's had his day in the sun here, because that actor, his name was Ernie Hudson, like the black actor. And what happened is that they wanted somebody else to play that role. They wanted Eddie Murphy to play that role. Right? He couldn't do it. So then they massively reduced the role. If you notice, Winston is like barely in Ghostbusters. It's because they reduced the role. Then, years later, they made a cartoon, which I used to like as a kid, called The Real Ghostbusters. Remember, like, Egon had the ice cream hair and so on, and this was like in the 80s? Well, in that cartoon, The Real Ghostbusters, obviously, you know, they didn't get... what's his name? Bill Murray to play Peter Venkman. Like they couldn't get like the proper cast. And funnily enough, the guy they brought in to do Peter Venkman, his name was Lorenzo Music, who was the voice of Garfield. Remember Garfield?
Okay, yeah.
And strangely, when they then made the Garfield movie, the voice of Garfield was given to Bill Murray. So clearly, like, Bill Murray big times this Lorenzo Music guy, but anyway, when they made The Real Ghostbusters cartoon, Ernie Hudson was like, "Hey, I'm available. I can, like, I want to be Winston, man. I'm actually him." So they made him audition. They made Winston audition, and then the casting guy said, you just don't sound like Winston enough. So they didn't give him, so they gave the role of Winston to someone else. So in a strange way, because I knew that, because I knew this little bit of nerd lore, when I saw Winston Zeddemore with a cue all the way up the back, I was like, oh, at least he's had his day in the sun.
Right.
Who had the last, right. Laugh, who had the last laugh, real Ghostbusters guy?
Yeah.
So, you know, I like,
you know, the lore on Bill Murray, right? Apparently he's just such an asshole. He's just terrible to work with. Yes, on the set of Groundhog Day, the director, people are going to lambast me in the comments. His name escapes me. But he was quite good friends with Bill Murray before they shot. And then shooting the movie destroyed their friendship because Bill Murray was just so difficult to work with. He's just like famously a jerk to fans, and people hate working with him, despise him. Really? But that movie's a masterpiece, so I kind of don't care. It's like whatever happened with your interpersonal relationships, you gave us Groundhog Day. So
I enjoy Groundhog Day quite a lot. Yeah, I always read stories that Bill Murray does weird things, like he'll kind of just walk into places and like pick food up, and he just turns up and like he does random stuff like that. So I heard, but
I believe it. He seems like a smelly guy too.
well, there we are. So, want to talk about anything else?
This is the riveting content, people. Well, it's nice to have a normal, light chat about things, especially after Henry Nowak and all these things going on. I'm sure you've been following this Sudanese beheading this week in Belfast. Just an absolute travesty. And the conversation just gets so heavy. So I heard you say something. Well, you actually made a whole video about it, that this really feels like the tipping point in the UK. And I don't have my finger on the pulse of what's going on there in a real way like you do, but I feel like I've been around for so long. I've been doing this for 10 years that when I hear something like that, my instinct is just to scoff and be like, well, we'll see about that. But do you really think that this is pivotal for the UK?
Well, Nigel Farage gave something that he said, I'm going to give an address to the nation.
I heard it.
And in that address, he used the phrase White Lives Matter, which was a big win for, do you remember No White Guilt back in the day?
I do.
I think he's still around, actually. He commented on that video. Jason, like that was his phrase all the way back in the day. He used that phrase. He said he used the phrase anti-white, and he said that there needs to be pure cold rage. Mm. So obviously, there has been some violence since then, and Tommy and the lads went down there, which is usually what happens with these sorts of things. And now there's a big attempt to try to blame Nigel Farage for this violence because he used the phrase pure cold rage. The thing is that, correct me if I'm wrong, but Trump has never used the phrase, he's never even used the word white in all of his speeches, or whereas Nigel Farage has actually used the word white now, and he's actually,
I'm not sure.
I don't recall. I mean, I remember on the campaign trail, he would do this thing of going round. Oh, we've got brilliant Hispanic voters, and our beautiful black voters, and so on. But he'd never name the white voters. He'd dog whistle at them. He'd kind of play the old kind of word. He'd kind of like give a nod and a wink that he was your guy, but he'd never actually use that phrase. Whereas Farage has actually said it, which to me seems like something. Now, obviously Farage is a fake and a phony, as everybody knows, and is a containment mechanism. But the very fact that he felt the need to come out and say that suggests to me that there's going to be some sort of shift. I don't know much about this, but this Belfast thing's only happened like today. So I don't know much about, this is still a developing story. I like to apply the 3-day rule before I comment on stuff. Whereas this Novak thing happened, it actually happened all the way back in December. Mm-hmm. And is kind of it's not really a reheated story. What happened is the police released the footage, and that footage had, you know, nobody had seen that before, which is,
they didn't release all the footage though. There's the footage of, is it Digwa? That, yeah, chasing Henry Nowak after he had been stabbed repeatedly, including the fatal stab, and he's trying to hop over trash cans and Digwa's slashing him in the back of, in the calves. He's stabbing him in the calves. They said it was too disturbing to be released, but I think that that's important. People deserve to see that as well, that there was a pursuit after he had been mm-hmm. delivered a fatal blow. So I'm not sure how anybody can retain any sympathies. In terms of the political externality of this, I mean, it couldn't be better for racially conscious people, because Sikhs have a reputation of being very peaceful. That's what they always say. The Sikhs are so peaceful. And Henry Nowak was Polish. He was, you know, British, but he was of mm-hmm. Polish descent. And so I think that this case in particular really stripped away some of these citizenry issues and made it and laid bare what the real issue is that it's racial. He was Polish, but he was one of ours. And mm-hmm. this, and Digwa was Sikh, and he's not one of ours. And I like the way that we've been able to utilize that, as grim and ghoulish as that may sound. But I think that we, it's incumbent on us to definitely use tragedies like this for our benefit.
One of the slight things, well, I say it's an issue, the way that the mainstream are dealing with this, as you can imagine, they're still, I mean, the left in general are still going around the houses to not admit that this happened, like, because he was white, or because there's a racial component to this when it's so obvious. Or that it happened because of, you know, anti-racism efforts, or, you know, all this sort of stuff. But because Americans keep on commenting on it, now the move has been, oh, Americans are trying to influence our politics, right? So they're because, you know, J.D. Vance came out and said something. So they're trying to do this maneuver now where it's like, you know, and then suddenly the story has gone from the story itself to, oh, look at what Farrar just said. Now look at what Vance is doing. Now it's the right who are stirring up racial tension. So you see how they try to spin it.
Are you susceptible to this manufactured disdain for Americans? I bet you are.
Well, I mean, I'm not. See, the thing is that I do think that there is an element of truth that the US wants some sort of regime change in Britain, right? That they don't want Starmer there. They'd rather have Farage there. And you know why that is. Mm-hmm. So that's the difficult part, because these things that we're talking about and the actual issue is real with the Nowak thing. But remember, I always said, your anger, their agenda. Think about, like, go back around the houses, right? If Nigel Farage had been the prime minister, we would have joined the Iran war. Mm-hmm. Fact, right? So, yeah. And the thing is that these people, they always know that there's more than one way to skin a cat, right? If you don't get there one way, you can get there two or three other ways. And I mean, I do think that there is a certain extent to which some of this stuff is, it is a really serious issue, right? It's a really serious issue, but there is an extent to which the way it's ginned up, then who does it then end up benefiting politically? Mm-hmm. And in our case, it's going to be Nigel. I mean, the fact is, it's going to be Nigel Farage. The other thing is, though, there is another party here, Restore, Rupert Lowe, who I'm sure you've heard of. I think, and I put out a Substack bit earlier today saying this, I think one of the reasons that Farage went as hard as he did is because they feel they're, like, super aware of Restore. I mean, they keep on doing this thing saying, oh, you know, they're a distraction, who cares about them, they're fringe. But it's like they cannot stop talking about it.
Right.
It's like it's on their mind all the time. Almost in the way, like, I suppose the closest thing, it's not an exact analogy, but it is kind of, is that over in America, there's been a whole bunch of people saying, oh, Tucker Carlson's irrelevant, who cares about him anymore, right? And yet, what's all they do is talk about him all the time, seemingly, something like that. It's not an exact analogy, but it's something like that, where it's like they've got into the heads, like all of the, you know, all the minions online, all the little guys on Twitter, all the Tory boys and so on. They basically, all they do is try to attack Restore 24/7 because they know that people see Farage and Reform as phony and they see Restore as the real deal. So I think the system is moving to try to occupy that space before Restore can occupy it or something like that.
One of the reasons I like to listen to you is that you're still invested in the political sphere. You still believe that there's a political solution. And I'm so far removed from that in America that it'll be very interesting to see if anybody in Western Europe is able to achieve this through political means. I mean, Nigel Farage just seems like such a laughingstock at this point. I mean, I have high hopes for Restore because my British friends do. And I just have to be like, they know more about this than I do. If they are hopeful about this, then, you know, then I should be as well. But I do find it interesting that you must still believe that there's a political solution.
Well, I mean, that article I released earlier on Substack, I should mention, I mean, look, I did write this book some years ago, Populist Illusion, right? So I cannot, in my heart of hearts, say that I believe in democracy or I believe that, you know.
Oh, I didn't ask you that.
But there is still a thing, you know, I talk about containment a lot, right? Containment. But how can I put this? Historically, the way people get concessions from the powers that be, right, it does take a political fight. It does take organization, but eventually they can extract a concession from the king, from the government, they have to give something, right? And historically, the British system, right, the ruling class has been very good at staying in power. But it's also, in order to stay in power, has to trade stuff off all the time.
Yes.
So, like one of the things I talked about in the late 19th century, in the height of laissez-faire libertarian fans, in the classical liberal era, there were hundreds of strikes, right? That is, the workers organized and they're like, look, if you don't stop tying our wages to the price of coal, if you don't stop trying to make us work 15 hours every day and so on, we're just not going to work. And they I mean, all throughout the 1890s there were hundreds and hundreds of work days lost. And so what was the British ruling class's solution to this? This is the height of the empire, don't forget. They're like, right, we're gonna have to do something here, or there's gonna be a communist revolution. Right, there's gonna be a Marxist revolution here, and the workers are gonna take over, or they're gonna cause so much trouble, the empire is gonna implode.
Right.
So that's really the story of the start of the modern day Labour Party. The party that Keir Starmer is in charge of now started as, well, the ruling class can kind of give the appearance that the workers are now involved in the process. Now you've got people in parliament who used to be foremen in mines or working in a factory or something else. Okay. And so that is typically been the way that they are able to bring in. This is why it is containment, because they're not being overthrown. But don't forget, in that process, you're still getting something, right? If you're that worker who only has to work 8 hours a day as opposed to 15 hours a day, you got something for it. You won that through political struggle, right? You got something for it. Or I don't know. I hate this. If you're a woman, you're one of the suffragettes or something, now you've got a vote, you know.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
Oh. You understand, right? It's still something, right? So the political process has given some, like, it's got something. Or all right, you put it in you think in America, like, okay, so in the American case, there, all of these processes happened as well. It happened a little bit later on in the 40s and the 50s, but there were all sorts of things, right? I've said it before. Pat Buchanan's childhood, the white picket fences, the lovely 1950s America everyone wants to get back to. But what about the antitrust laws that had to be fought for? What about the union rights? What about like all of those things that had to be fought through? Like they had to fight for it. People had to go hungry. People had to struggle in order to get those concessions for the bastards that run the place. So
no, I understand, but all of this predates our forthcoming minority status in our previously homogenous nations, and it predates massive third world migration from completely disparate nations. That's so cool. Is the political process even relevant anymore? I mean, I'm sure you read, I know you read it because you discussed it on your channel, but Millennial Woe's Substack on Henry Nowak was so excellent. What are we going to do when not only were the minority in our own nations, but all the systems that are there to serve and protect us are also white minority? I mean, we're going to have no political power, no opportunity to change things through political power. And then anything that we do that's going to achieve success is going to be extra systemic. That's going to be the only way. And that is coming down the pipeline faster than most people think. We can't even get a good number on what percentage of Americans are white. We don't really know, but I think it's probably sub 50 at this point.
Well, one of the things that Jonathan Bowden talked about many years ago when he was still alive was, you know, one of his famous speeches, he says, look, to a certain extent, when that happens, you're going to have to start playing the same games as everyone else, right? That is, I mean, it's basically white Sal Sharpton.
Yeah, right. I'm fine with that.
It's white, right? So basically what you then end up with is white minority rights. Mm-hmm. So that you are just another group fighting for your piece of the pie amongst all the other groups, right? I mean, and this is something in this country, I think Nick Griffin has talked about this, the former leader of the BNP and various other people, that eventually it will come to that. There's a part of me that wonders about this Nowak case, right? Where, because you know, it's like I can't breathe. I was reviewing some leftist channels earlier on. There's this communist Indian girl, or you know, woman now called Ash Sarkar. You've probably come across it at some point, right? Well, she was saying, do you know what? I think people should take the knee for Henry Nowak. People should take the knee. And I was thinking, so there's the George Floyd, there's the I can't breathe. Now you've got leftists saying people should take the knee for this, right? Take the, like they took the knee for George Floyd. And I'm thinking like, well, if this is white George Floyd, are we just basically moving into a situation where you're getting white Al Sharpton?
Yes,
of course. Right. So, and then if that happens, like, are you happy with that?
I mean, I'm not happy with it, but if reverting to tribalism is going to retain white majorities in our own nations, you know, I'll do what it takes. If we have to get in the mud here, then I'm fine with that. I'm not going to allow the extinction of my people because I don't want to fight dirty. My principles are not more important than that. So anything that needs to be done, it needs to be done at any cost.
Interesting. Well, yeah, you see, theoretically, I can see it. But, you know, I look at the history of civil rights in America, and, you know, the real history of civil rights. And, you know, it's not just Martin Luther King speeches, right? I mean, I've got all these Thomas Sowell books here. I mean, they smashed the place up. Mm-hmm. They basically burnt the place down in the 60s, like burnt Detroit. Like they, what I'm saying is the civil rights movement got its way basically through violence back in the day. They were violent. And it was kind of, and then we basically saw a repeat of it in the Summer of Love. They were violent then as well. And I mean, I remember seeing people will forget this now. I remember seeing footage on Twitter of them like, you know, torturing a dog and things like that. You know, some awful things that happened in 2020. And yet everybody was bending over backwards for them. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in Europe, you know, all of the trouble people have had with, you know, the Muslims. You know, I'm not a big Tommy Robinson fan, as you know, but.
Why?
Like, why am I not a big Tommy Robinson fan? <I'm> just... But you, like, part of me is like, well, you know, all the fact is, people like the powers that be tread carefully around the black rights groups, and they tread carefully around the, you know, around the various Muslim groups, because the thing that they're really scared of at the end of the day is disorder. Is violent. Like you've got to remember, our elites are a kind of fox elite. They prefer sneaky games of persuasion, and they don't like to use force. When they do use force, it's kind of clumsy. Do you remember when Justin Trudeau called the truckers in? Do you remember and it was kind of a mess, right? It doesn't. They don't really like to go. We can actually contrast it. Let's just remember back in Iran, where there was the failed attempt to overthrow the regime in Iran, and the regime in Iran was like, right, we're going to round up every single one of these things. Gone, all of them, dead. Right now, obviously, the media exaggerated that. You know, it wasn't really 30,000; it was probably less than that. But that is a regime that has no. It just doesn't care about that sort of stuff. It doesn't have a problem with using force, is what I mean. Okay? Like back in the day, like Stalin had no problem. Putin has no problem with being like, look, my rival there, he was my rival before, and now he's dead, by the way, because you know who the boss is. Our elites don't do that, right? As much as people want to, you know, Joe Biden, as much as he talked tough and all that, he didn't really do it, did he? And our, you know, they may lock a couple of people up and things like that, but they still tread really carefully. And so, in a roundabout way, what I'm saying is, if people go down this route, people go down the route of the White Al Sharpton and that kind of politics, I think it comes wrapped up with a lot of other stuff as well.
Right.
You know, street violence, you know, I'm not encouraging anybody to do any of this stuff. I'm just saying that as a fact of when politics goes that way, it also becomes kinetic. And as we're seeing in the streets right now in Britain, it becomes kinetic quite quickly.
Of course. A few things about that. I think that the way that we can counter their reliance on us being, on white people being orderly citizens, is to introduce some chaotic element. I'm not advocating for violence, but don't you think that we have done our due diligence trying to reason our way out of this situation? I think we've expended every possible nonviolent alternative, and nothing else is left except for our extinction. At this point, what do they expect? And I think that you're right, that the expectation is that we will remain docile in perpetuity, and we need to relieve them of that expectation.
Yeah, well, I mean, how can I put this? I mean, there are other ways, though. There's kind of like mass non-compliance. Let's face it. What's the tax base? It's the tax base. Basically, what we're talking about, the productive part of society that is taxed.
But they're blowing up the economy. We could very well be experiencing Weimar Germany levels of hyperinflation in our respective nations within the next decade. If they do that, then what does it matter? There's no economic prosperity to be had outside of the super elite class, in which case violence is a virtual inevitability. So, I mean, they either are short-sighted or they have something up their sleeve. And I believe they're being short-sighted. They're underestimating the vigor of white people. Look at how we have behaved when our backs have been against the wall in a multitude of historical struggles. It would be good for them to look upon those and, you know, be instilled with some level of fear, or at least apprehension. Good Lord.
But don't you think, though, that, you know, if we can see this, if me and you can see this, some of them on the Hill can see this, not all of them, but some of them on the Hill in Washington can see it, and some of them in London can see this. And this is why I always think that the containment thing, I mean, I think in America it happened already. I think Trump 2.0 was containment.
Yes.
I wasn't popular for saying so, right? But imagine a scenario where they didn't let Trump win again.
Right.
Or where we had another 4 years of Joe Biden or Kamala Harris, kind of woke America, all this sort of stuff. So in a way, Trump did act as a massive pressure release valve. Now you can say, well, he's disappointed lots of people or whatnot, but what didn't happen is mass civil unrest. What didn't happen is
right, but it's proven ineffective because they applied a Band-Aid. They didn't treat the root problem, which is multiculturalism. If they were serious about long-term containment and they had foresight into the average American gripes, then they would have helped or aided in some sort of mass deportation effort. That would have caused, would have allowed for some long-term containment. But Trump is now just being seen as a disappointment to even the most ardent MAGA advocates. And I think that it has laid the groundwork for worse outcomes in the near future. I mean, I think it was a totally ineffectual operation, if that was their intent, which it probably was, which leads me to believe that they don't know. And all of these people that are saying that they're civic advocates, that they come from grassroots, like look at our J.D. Vance, grew up with a single mom, poor, drugs, blah, da, da, da. He is an elite through and through. I think these people are massively disconnected from the plight of average Americans, or they just don't care. And in the UK, they all went to these multiracial super elite schools. I think that it's very possible that they just have no idea, or they don't care.
One weird question I've got to ask you, but I have to ask it, is that J.D. Vance, right, commented on the Novak situation. And I can't remember exactly what he said, but he has been very vocal in attacking the British government and European governments for their policy of multiculturalism. They're saying the experiment's gone wrong and so on. And obviously he's right. But then I'm thinking, like, hold on a second. America's like 57% at this point, or even lower than that. And you're literally the vice president. So as an American, when you see the vice president commenting on Britain or on Germany or on some other things, basically saying like, oh, you need to sort your immigration problem out. You need to sort your multiculturalism out. And then I'm thinking, yeah, but like, look at America. Like is America doing any better? So how do you process that when Vance is making comments like this on other countries?
Well, I just don't listen to any of the public statements from elites because I know they're carefully crafted to address discontent within areas of the populace that they're courting for some nefarious purpose. And so what does it matter what they say? I've even stopped listening to Trump on Iran. It's like nothing material comes from any of this. There'll be some subtle market movements from day to day that aren't sustainable. But outside of that, this is all just useless fodder for whatever they're ginning up in their elite class. So I just don't particularly care. He has no business, of course, talking about the multiracial elements of Britain that are causing social issues. I mean, we have those problems in spades. It's arguably worse here because there's been so much miscegenation and people have, some of these Mexican immigrants have been their third generation now. It's like, what are we supposed to do about this? But it's a lot easier for him to address that in the public sphere and be like, oh yeah, I'm based, without having to address any of America's problems. But J.D. Vance, like all of them, full of shit. It's full of shit.
Mm-hmm. Just before we wrap this up, Rebecca, I mean, I have not really been keeping my eye on American politics too much because it's,
why bother?
I've kind of tuned Trump out, just same as you. I haven't since April.
It's the only way to tolerate what's going on.
After like the 15th go round of, you better do this or I'm going to bomb you back to the Stone Age. Oh, nothing happens again. I mean, it's just, I'm done with Trump. But like, what is the current state of, because it's kind of hard to get a read from over here, but I just feel like the GOP is done, that the public, like every, but I have no sense of what's actually happening, because you know, you get a lot of the kind of I see a lot of anti-Tucker sentiment. A lot, there's so much stuff that is bound up with slot personality politics. You know, Fuentes said this, or what's this Asmongold guy said, or like, it's all that stuff is slop. What's actually happening on the right in American politics? Because I haven't got to read it all at the minute.
I think there's massive apathy towards our political system, and that people are just extricating themselves from it, like you and I have. I think that is a widespread sentiment. I have a moratorium on talking about Iran until something actually happens on my show, The Reset. I'm like, I'm not doing this every week where we're in peace talks. They're imminent. We violated the sea. I'm not doing any of this shit anymore until something material happens. And I think it's a case study, but I think that is kind of what average Americans are dealing with. They're tired of all of the promises of Trump. And the only people that are really hanging on are these old time boomer MAGA folk. And there really aren't that many of them. I think Gen Z, Gen Alpha is just checked out.
Are there many MAGA copers around online? I mean, I've zoomed it all out. I kind of zoned it all out. I don't really take any notice anymore, but I don't know what my old American buddies are saying or anything, because I just don't
know. No. I mean, his position in Iran is simply indefensible. It's erratic at a minimum. It's malicious, probably. And I think that it's just so wildly unpopular that even his greatest advocates are at least shutting their mouths about it. I mean, I'm even seeing some pushback on Fox News and things like that, because nobody wants to destroy their own brand for this. They know that they'll try to have a career after the Trump administration, so they need to start looking credible now. And it's just such a highly unpopular opinion. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I think that he doesn't have very much support. His polling is at an all-time low, if it's to be believed.
Right. Well, okay. But are there still, because it feels like they've done this kind of desperate thing of like buying lots of assets or buying like magazines and podcasts and like trying to get as many people on payroll as possible. But I just, as soon as I see that somebody's just on that, like got on that train, or they're, as soon as in my mind, it's just like, yeah, shill. Done.
Oh, of course. I mean,
I don't watch anyone anymore.
They've tried to do that, and it's, look at what happened with Dan Bongino, and he's just a laughing stock of the entire sphere. You can tell when somebody's bought and paid for because they're still puffing up Trump. That's how you can tell, yeah. That they're Zionists, or that they're being paid for by the Trump administration or Zionist lobbies or anything like that. And that's why people are leaving these podcasts and leaving these audiences in droves to go over to, you know, if Fuentes or whoever else they're going over to. And that's why these people have historic popularity. So, you know, I'm hopeful about that, because that means that people are going to be looking for other solutions. And that's where we will be here waiting for 10 years. Come over to my channel. It's been stuck at 126,000 subscribers for, you know, almost a decade.
I almost feel that even that thing, even like Fuentes and Tucker and all that, even that feels like it's kind of like that's become its own shit show as well.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, I feel like, I don't know, I kind of zoned out from all of that stuff as well, because there's so much like Jerry Springer crap with all of that.
Like, that's true. There's a lot of drama. And I think on the dissident right, we like the scrappier guys. And so once somebody reaches some kind of mainstream popularity, you think it would give you more power, but it has this neutralizing effect for a lot of people where they're like, why are we allowed to hear what you have to say now? Some subversive opinion must be trying to breach the mainstream collective for this to be permitted. And I think that's what's happening to Fuentes. I mean, he's so much more popular than I am, so this isn't some kind of cope, but he's not doing as well as he was, I don't know, 6 months ago, 8 months ago. And I think a lot of that has to do with what he said about the multiracial collective and it's advocacy for a multiracial Catholicism. And I think that people find that distasteful. And a lot of it is just, you know, personal dramas, which are superficially entertaining, but they don't serve to move us in any meaningful direction. And Tucker kind of has some of that. Of course, Candace, the slop queen, she has a lot of that too. But I am happy to see people listening to them initially, because I'm hopeful that they will cross over. Because you don't just start listening to Candace Owens and then you're only listening to Candace Owens for 10 years. That's not really how how it progresses. Most people move on. They need the harder stuff. And so they come over eventually.
Right. All right. Well, it's been fun. We've done everything from, did the whole gamut. We even talked about Bill Murray at some point. I still remember all the way back.
It's always lovely talking to you. Thank you so much.
Where can people find you?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter. I am blondes_tweets. Please come to our event July 18th in New York City. All of the details and how to RSVP can be found in the flyer on my pinned tweet. That is blondes_tweets. You can find me on YouTube. I am Rebecca Hargraves, Blonde in the Belly of the Beast. I have two YouTube channels because one was in danger of getting nuked. So I have Blonde in the Belly of the Beast. I also have @RebeccaHargraves1. You can find me on Rumble @BlondeBeast. I think that's it. I host a show with Devin Stack on Wednesday called Outlaws. Every Wednesday. And that is at 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Wednesdays. I host a show called The Reset with Cameron McGregor on Thursdays. That is noon Pacific Standard Time on Thursdays on Blonde in the Belly of the Beast. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Fantastic. All right. Well, talk again soon.
Bye-bye.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.